if we want to, there are other important days in Lord of the Rings, like in the Lord of the Rings calendar. So like Lord of the Rings nerds really pay attention to, I think it's March 25th and September 22nd, because March 25th is in universe the day when he destroys the ring, and September 22nd is in universe Bilbo's birthday.
Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lits. I'm Nick Karchiris. And today I'm looking for, what am I looking for?
The best Lord of the Rings for? Book?
Well, the best Lord, I don't think it could be the best Lord
no,
of the Rings
that's
book.
It.
I think it just has to, you have to be looking for the first Lord of the Rings book.
Ah, yes, that's it. I'm looking for the first Lord of the Rings book. Now, Ian, what is that called again?
The Fellowship of the Ring.
Oh, lovely.
Why are we doing just this? Like, why are we releasing this today?
Oh.
Because Tolkien's birthday was yesterday. Happy birthday, JRRT.
I think that's a rhetorical strategy when you ask a question and then answer it yourself. Like, there's a hypothetical question.
I was legitimately hoping that Nick would remember that. Yeah. And that's why we're doing this episode today. And he did not.
I was thinking if we were going to start over or not.
So what I love about rhetorical questions is they make the audience feel smart. Like, you ask a question and they figure out the answer. What I like about what Ian just did is it makes the audience feel dumb. May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Yeah, so happy birthday, J.R.R. Tolkien. Is that right?
John Ronald Raoul? Rule?
I think it's Rule. But that Rules. Third name throws me for a loop.
I wish I had two middle names sometimes. You know, like I got one. It's pretty good. It's after my grandpa, but like it'd be nice to have a second one.
Just in case something happened to the first one?
Just in case. Right. Just in case.
Emergency names.
I think it's a little selfish, Joe. Save some names for the rest of us.
Well, yeah, that's the thing about names. Like, it's not a zero-sum game. Like, you can just have as many as you want. We're watching The Crown. I feel like I've been talking about The Crown a lot of these episodes lately. Mm-hmm, but those guys have all sorts of names and titles. And, that's right. Know,
yeah, but you know why? You know why they have those names? It's because they're rich and wealthy, and they have exclusive access to the name wells. You know that there are wells where they pull up these names in various places. And when those wells run dry, Joseph, Joel.
Then they have to colonize. They colonize Africa.
That is where colonialism comes from.
I believe in trickle-down namonomics.
Ooh, good. Good. So like the people at the top get a lot of names.
Yeah, they get the most names.
Right.
And they spend them?
We just get whatever is left.
Right.
They spend them.
They spend the names.
Is R a middle name? What is his name? Are these middle names or part of his first name? Maybe he's got three first names and there's no middle name. Do we have any clarification on this, Ian? Sorry to just jump right into it, but
that's a really good question.
Walk us through the dots and letters.
Also, I believe that they're all first names, and if any of them is a last name, it would be Tolkien, but that could even be a first name itself, which... Okay, sure. As far as like a strategy for an author, it's really good because you want people to keep listening. And what better way to keep people hooked than by having a bunch of names that seem to be leading somewhere but actually aren't?
Mm-hmm. Kind of like that sentence.
Yeah, exactly like that sentence.
Okay, great.
Okay.
I'm glad we got some clarification on that. Ian, I guess, and Joe, but let's just cut right to it. Ian, sure. You are basically a Lord of the Rings doctor. Is that correct?
Doctor of Hobbits, Dr. Ian DeYoung.
That is unfortunately incorrect. If someone brought me a Hobbit who was bleeding out, I could not operate them. I could not operate on them.
I think apply pressure.
Yeah, right. Just squeeze the tubes. It'll be fine.
I think it's just the same. They bleed like us.
If you stick us, do we not bleed? That's Shakespeare. No, I'm not a Lord of the Rings professor, unfortunately, but I do love it a lot, and I'm very happy to be talking about this stuff. So
Okay. Joe, what are you going to bring to the table? Anything on this episode? Or?
Yeah, so I actually struggled with this quite a bit when preparing for this episode.
Oh no! Did I Arnold Schwarzenegger a whole theme?
A whole episode?
Oh boy!
Yeah. No, it's
we're okay
it's
with
good.
That.
I also like Lord of the Rings. I wouldn't say I wish I had a doctorate in it or call myself a doctor of hobbits like Ian does. Mm-hmm. But I think Lord of the Rings is fine. And I'm prepared to talk about it.
Fantastic. Okay, good. So
ringing endorsement there.
We're going to start with the first Lord of the Rings because we didn't really know any other way to handle them in a single episode because there's three and that's an odd number and it just doesn't work with the format of this show. So we're going to do them in all cop-out episodes.
when you least expect them, a cop-out episode will spring out from behind the couch and wave its arms at you and say, it's the Lord of the Rings again.
Unless you're really familiar with the Lord of the Rings calendar and important dates in the mythology. In that case, they will arrive exactly when you most suspect them.
You are painting us into a corner, Joe, with scheduling.
So welcome, everybody, to You Don't Know Lit. Now, we typically pick a theme and two books to match against each other, but on our cop-out episodes we just do one, and so we still have some rules. Even though this is the first book of three, so I don't think there's anything you can really spoil, rule number one. No, I don't think there's anything.
Season on the spoilers. Good times.
Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing that's important here on You Don't Know Lit. Without further ado, do you want the full 30, Ian? Do you want to give some of that to Joe? Or how are we doing our 30-second plot?
I did prepare a series of limericks that describe the plot, so I could read those. It'll probably be more than 30 seconds though.
Okay, we can be lenient.
Sure, okay. you can have my time.
Just
thank you.
We're ready.
Okay, so here are the limericks. I really really don't want a sick beat underneath these because limericks are the most anti-musical form of poetry.
They have the same sick beat.
Definitely putting music under here.
No sick beats. Frodo Baggins, a hobbit of Hobbiton, had a ring. Great power it brought to him. A wizard said, destroy this ring, it's no toy. Mount Doom is the place where you'll drop it in. Frodo's gardener, a bumpkin named Samwise, went along to dispose of this prize. They became best of friends, and by the book's end, Sam was one of Frodo's only allies. Along with these two, there were more to help in their quest. Here's their core. Hobbits, an elf, and humans. Wizard, dwarf, but no womans. Affirmative action was definitely ignored. The first book really lays the foundation for the fellowship's travel and ruination. The pull of the ring makes Boromir fling apart the whole group. Oh, damnation.
Joe, I feel like we should have been in the background just going, oh, yeah! Just kind of like hype crowd, like hype men.
There are no women on this adventure, but I don't know if you can say affirmative action is ignored. There's elves and dwarves and a lot of hobbits. Like, it's pretty multicultural.
Racially diverse. Oh, boy.
Wait, are there no women?
Dude, there are startlingly few female characters in The Lord of the Rings.
Really? Oh, no. Let's ruin Tolkien.
It's really strange because, like, Tolkien doesn't have a problem with like, strong women. Like, in his other stories, there are all kinds of, like, really powerful magic users and strong, brave women who deal with, you know, hardship and toil and victory and stuff. But in The Lord of the Rings, for whatever reason, there's one who shows up in the next book. But here, Fellowship is pretty dude-centric.
All right. It's a sausage fest.
I do have a little bit about Tolkien and women. I have very little Tolkien facts because when you... there's a tremendous amount of information on him. When you read his Wikipedia page, it is like you are reading the Wikipedia page of the Queen of England. Like, this dude's life is heavily documented.
Really?
Really. Like, probably the most documented author that we've talked about so far.
Huh. Is there any books on him? I'm sure there are, right? That would be part of the documentation you've been mentioning, but, like, any, like, notable ones?
That's a question for Ian.
There's one. I'm looking it up right now to make sure I get the name right.
In the meantime, I'd like to talk about the engagement to his wife. There's just a really good line in his Wikipedia that I dug a lot. It's from one of his letters. So Tolkien was, he was kind of an artsy fartsy when he was younger. He went to school. He was a really good student. He deferred his enlistment in the army so he could finish college. This is during World War One, and it was a thing that was pretty frowned upon at the time.
This is the first of our authors who did not drop out of college.
No, he finished college. He had very little interest in fighting in war.
Smart guy, huh?
His wife agreed to marry him, which was very lucky. And in one of his letters to a friend, he said it was awfully nice of her to be willing to marry a man with no job, little money, and no prospects except for the likelihood of being killed in the Great War. I really thought that was a nice line. No job, no money, and no prospects except for the war.
With all of our extremely famous authors, I always find it the most fascinating to know which ones were actually wealthy and which ones were not when they either were in their prime or towards the end of their life. Was this guy ever rich? Did he ever get his money? Did he ever get paid?
Well, he was an academic his whole career.
So no.
And yeah.
He started writing The Hobbit when he needed extra money. And so he was taking on odd jobs to make money as a professor. Mm-hmm. And I was leafing through my copy of the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien because I am a hopeless nerd.
Yes.
And yes. I came across a wonderful letter where he's yelling at someone in 1956 about the movie that's going to come out soon. He thinks it's not. But he says in that letter, kind of like really pathetically, even though I really hate this script, I also need money right now and I will shortly need a lot of money. Because his health was failing and stuff. So yes, he was not a millionaire.
Wait, like you said, that was The Hobbit.
No,
in that situation.
So he was taking on extra work in the 30s when he wrote The Hobbit. He was grading papers, to get kind of it was a side hustle, because he had a family and stuff.
I guess what I was saying is was he like sick for a long part of his life or something?
Oh no, not like sick. Just he was getting older, and as he got older, oftentimes, gotcha. I don't know if you know this, Nick, but sometimes as we get older, our bodies break down. We don't work this as well as we used to. Biography that I would recommend is the authorized biography written by Humphrey Carpenter called simply J.R.R. Tolkien, A Biography.
Thank Fantastic. You for that recommendation. I don't know how we would have found that book without your help.
That endless pursuit of knowledge, finding the title of that book, Ian. Thank you.
So, guys, we've been doing a lot of weird year-end episodes. We did a cop-out with Spooktacular 2, and then we had Revenge of the Nerd, Nick Strikes Back. Mm-hmm.
Classics.
Mm-hmm. And now we've got this. This is another cop-out one. Are we ever going to get back to the classic, the real classic, which is Mad Max style, Thunderdome, two books enter, one book leaves, bloodied and broken?
Yeah.
Are we ever going back to that?
Back to what we do best.
Right. The premise of the show.
Let's get back to the basics, Ian.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Are there any
sounds good
one-hit wonder books out there?
And when you say one-hit wonder, what do you mean?
I mean, these authors, they came in, they did it right, but just once.
And then they noped out for the rest of their lives?
For the rest of their lives.
Right, so like Afro Man or Vanilla Ice or Chumbawamba.
Yeah, are there any Chumbawamba authors out there?
Like came in, did it right.
Perhaps the whoever wrote Chumbawamba.
I'm just frantically discovering whether Chumbawamba ever wrote or published a book.
Is there a biography by Chumbawamba?
They haven't been doing anything else. It would be.
Oh, yes, we do have. Okay, the part of the initial lineup, as you know, of Chumbawamba was involved a fellow named Alan Boff Whaley. And Whaley did end up writing a book called Footnote, which is an autobiography and involves a long section on the history of the band Chumbawamba.
Instead of the book from Chumbawamba, what are you going to bring, Ian?
I'm going to bring one of my all-time favorite books. It's a classic of science fiction. It's called A Canticle for Leibovitz. The author is Walter M. Miller Jr. And it is just, oh my goodness, it's mind-blowing. It won the Hugo Award in 1961. And oh man, I cannot wait to talk about it.
Sounds pretty good. I've never heard of it. Nick, I have a book that you have probably heard of. It is part of the Western canon. It is part of the Eastern canon. It's read by MBA grads and war gamers everywhere. Mm-hmm. I'm, of course, talking about The Art of War by Sun Tzu. I have to figure out how to say his name. I think it's Sun Tzu.
Did you keep
Sun
saying Tzu. Western canon, Eastern canon, because canons are things used in war?
Yeah, that's exactly it. This is where the term Western canon actually comes from, guys. It starts in this book.
Cannons were invented.
That's right. You point your cannons towards the west, you point your cannons towards the east, and that's the art of war.
Is there, who is this episode for? Is this for people who
Nick, that is the first bullet point in my notes. Nice. Who is this for?
Nice. And is this for nerds, or is this for people who already have decided they're never going to read this book?
Oh my God. Nick, you literally, I'm crossing off the first bullet point because my first one says, who is this for? If you haven't read Fellowship of the Ring, are you going to? Like, you're not going to. If you haven't read it, you won't.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know about that. Okay.
I bet Ian has some strong thoughts on this.
My second bullet point, I'm going to need to be the voice of reason in this episode. I think Ian is going to spend the next hour just speaking the virtues of Lord of the Rings. And I don't disagree in every point, but I'm going to be the voice of reason and just talk him down a little bit.
Ian, that's maybe let's just cut to the chase here. Tell us why this is the your favorite book and the world's greatest book ever written.
I don't know if I can say that. I have plenty of other favorites. It's up there, but I don't know. I will say, as far as the audience for this, I think so. I feel like the book had a huge impact on fantasy fiction, and then the film came along. And the film had this huge impact on fantasy film. Like
Sean Connery.
Did. he took that sorrow to his grave. And I kind of feel like there are probably a lot of people who may be familiar with the movie, but didn't read the book.
Yeah, it's got to be a huge number.
I'm always curious what survives generations. Like, I'm always surprised when I talk to my high schoolers. And like, there's certain pop culture from my childhood that just has survived, that they have seen. Like, they have seen E.T., they have seen Jaws, they've seen The Goonies, they've seen The Princess Bride, right?
Right.
When I ask my students if they've seen Lord of the Rings, none of them have. Like, just the nerdiest of the nerds have seen or really read Lord of the Rings at this point. And for some reason, it hasn't trickled down.
Oh, boy. Well, if it wasn't for the movies, there's no way this would be as popular. Or that I would have read the books. I don't even think I would have heard of them necessarily. I mean, I think the movies were just so enormous.
Yeah, they were big.
I don't know.
Well, and there's been so much money thrown at the whole IP, not just with the movies, but then with the Hobbit stuff. And now Amazon's new television show, which is reportedly, they paid a quarter of a billion? Did they pay a quarter of a billion for the rights?
Oh,
probably.
Yeah.
If
you want to deal with the Tolkien estate, you bring your checkbook.
Right. But like, I kind of think that so much money has been spent on it that it can't quite be forgotten, even though maybe some folks think it should.
What's this book about?
So this is, talking just about the Fellowship of the Ring. This is a book about a hobbit, of which we have had many facts on this show. This particular hobbit is called Frodo Baggins, a nephew of famous Bilbo Baggins from the book
Shire.
The Hobbit. From the Shire, yes. From under the hill. And he is kind of called to adventure, right? Like he is given this ring of power or comes across this ring of power. The nefarious nature of this ring of power comes to light. And he first through really no choice of his own, and then eventually through a choice of his own, sets out to destroy it with, if you're paying attention to Ian's Limerick Slidheads, a bunch of good buddies, a bunch of strangers that will become friends. And it's
bunch
an adventure book. A bunch of fellows.
A bunch of men.
A ship of fellows.
All right. Now, Ian, what did Joe get wrong in that sense?
Oh, so much. No, Joe did a really good job. I don't know. I think
really
I think
good
it's,
job.
It's a story that,
good job, Joe.
Good job. Hey, Joe. Joe, you can take 1 point for story.
So proud of you.
1 point for storytelling.
Fantastic. I will put it on my note sheet.
Joe, right, I'm going to give you another point for being able to remember the main character's name. Good job.
Yeah.
2 stars.
Guys, I have marked down 2 points, just so you know. I expect to be able to cash these in at a certain point.
At the end of the podcast.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you just go to the store and you talk to the shopkeeper and you sell some of your rusted scimitars.
I don't know. This book feels fun in certain areas. Is this like one of the first books to be like kind of like fun and not childish, but like whimsical? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think there's a couple things going on there. I think there are. Well, first of all, when it comes to like fantasy books, I think this is just one of the first books. Like so much about fantasy that we know today is built just on the shoulders of this book, right? Like when we think of elves, like when you think of the elf that you played in Dungeons and Dragons, when you think of, you know, the way that you understand this fantasy literature to work with dwarves and evil and good, like so much of that just comes from this book. And Tolkien was absolutely building on what came before, but he was building on folklore and mythology, and he was like canonizing it in a certain way for like the Anglo world.
As you say that, you remind me of how Dracula builds on folklore. Like Bram Stoker, when he could get away from his job at the theater, being the business manager of the theater, like was researching folklore. And he kind of turned this folklore into something which is popular and interesting and cohesive. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like there's maybe something similar going on here with Tolkien. Tolkien takes like a widely disparate sort of sketch, because he didn't just like, you know, read the old Icelandic poems and stuff, the old folklore, but he was also like paying attention to more modern storytelling. And so I wonder if that's kind of what we're drawn to with both Dracula, which has this huge impact on vampire fiction, and Lord of the Rings doing the same thing for fantasy.
Not only that, but I would say Dracula and Lord of the Rings, think of like the regional identity, like just geographically, that both of those places get out of that. Like when you think about Middle Europe, like it feels kind of Dracula-y, right? When you think about England, it feels Lord of the Rings-y, right?
Yeah,
like it feels like the Shire.
Yeah, it's weird.
I thought it took place in America.
American hobbits. Oof.
But
we do like to eat. I feel like there's this modern sense that fantasy has to be, and really maybe beyond fantasy, like this, I mean, it's the grim and gritty, right? It's the turn to like, oh, there's so much blood and guts, and there's violence, and there's like explicit sexual content. It's all just nasty and in your face and horrifying, kind of like the Dark Knight stuff. And obviously Tolkien's not responding to that because he died 40 years before that stuff started happening. But I feel like he has this idea that power doesn't necessarily have to be grim dark. Like cool can also be silly. Cool can be goofy. Like
can be like noble. You know, like noble and admirable.
It doesn't have
cool
to be.
Can be Gandalf getting stoned in every scene.
Oh boy.
Is that just in the movie or is that in the books too?
No, they have pipe weed in the books.
All right.
I mean, I think Tolkien would have thought of it as tobacco. And it really depends on your headcanon, but sure, certainly you can imagine.
I might be projecting a little.
Well, he calls it weed, though.
He does?
Oh, yeah. They were the shorthand for this, so it's called pipe weed, but the shorthand for it is weed. And so, like, it makes sense that modern minds go there, I think. That's fine.
Okay. Is just modern minds, or is that not what it was called back then?
I'm going to go look it up. Quick, to the Google machine.
Because, like, was he just... Maybe he was having a go at us. Because it seems like he's screwing with us if he's just calling it weed.
Oh, dear. The meaning of weed as marijuana dates back to the 1920s.
When did this book come out?
1950s.
Okay, ooh, so yeah, it's totally about it. That. You can just ask Led Zeppelin about that. I think they know. Mm-hmm. Why are there three books? Why didn't he just put it into one book? Just make it a little quicker. It's a pretty good story. Here we go. What's the whole point? What happens in this first book that just takes so long? Oh my God, it just keeps going.
I mean, there is a little bit of the narrative habit where you think they're going to make it really easily and then something happens and they have to go a different way. And so then they're going to be fine. And then something else happens. They have to go a different way. And they're just these obstacles that keep cropping up in their path, which gets a tiny bit annoying in this book.
One of the cool things, like, let me say some nice things about Lord of the Rings here. One of the cool things is for everything that's on the page, it feels like there are appendices and appendices and appendices backing it up. Like, it feels like there is so much lore and we really are just getting the surface of this. So if you're into it, and there are people that are so into it,
quote unquote into it.
Yeah, like I'm sure there are people out there who think that the Lord of the Rings, that's fine for the casual Tolkien fans, like those, you know, those 2000 pages, that's fine for the filthy casuals. We're over here reading appendices. and part of that is cool. Like, part of that is like, you know, this hanging out in this universe that is so deeply thought through and so richly detailed. But part of it, I think, especially as a first time reader, which is back to that Who Is This Podcast For episode, I think that can be really daunting. And Nick, you know, that first 100 pages, that first 150 pages of Lord of the Rings, it can be dense. And if you don't know what you're getting into, it can be, you know, you can get pretty far into it and still kind of think, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, but that's like the whole point. It's like a really dense journey.
Right.
You want all those sweet little doodads along the way. You don't want to just throw the ring in the right. lava fire.
Hop on an eagle and go there. Do you guys know the word mythopoeia?
Of course. Of course. Joe, do you?
Obviously, but I will let Ian explain.
Yeah, let's let him explain it for everybody else.
Basically, it's world building. It's when you build a whole mythology, a whole system.
From the Latin,
Anna. Yes. Did you want to add something, Nick?
I just did. I just did. Keep going.
Would you like to share with the entire class?
No, keep going.
You build a whole mythology and a whole...
I just realized that this whole podcast is the premise of me being the worst student ever. Just talking during class. This is basically it.
30 episodes in, we've found our brand.
I'd like to take this time to apologize to every teacher I've ever had, including Ian and Joe. All right, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just going to, like, the world building, basically, myth making.
Ah, yeah, that world building. Are you pro or con?
Am I pro or con world building?
Yeah, at world building. Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, I think it's, well, here's the thing. Okay, I think it's necessary in a lot of imaginative fiction. So, like, a lot of stories, we need things to flesh out the sort of the world, so it feels lived in. So it feels like there's actually stuff that happens. So, like, if you're playing Red Dead Redemption, that's a good example, or a Grand Theft Auto game, and you're like driving around and you like discover, oh, there's like some people having a fight over there, or there's a bear that's eating a corpse. Like, this gives you the sensation in the game that the world exists not just when you're there, but kind of apart from you. And that's a really cool feeling to have. The problem is, a lot of fiction does this wrong. A lot of fiction wants you to believe that there's this larger world. So it just gives you like dozens or hundreds of little references to that larger world. And like, before long, you're overwhelmed.
But Tolkien, here's the good news. Tolkien has kept them straight for you if you are willing to read the appendices.
So here's my thought. And I am open to this kind of being shot down brutally by your vicious mockery. Remember back when we talked about Silver Lock, which is the book where everything, all the characters were drawn from other fiction. We talked about the concept of intertextuality. You guys remember that?
Yes.
Intertext, like so when Silver Lock is running around the town and he runs into actual Beowulf, this is intertextuality.
Mm-hmm. Or actual Satan.
Or actual Satan, yes. Or Hamlet. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Silverlock was published before Lord of the Rings, or otherwise you know somebody from
you know Gandalf would be there.
Oh, man. So I think this book does intertextuality on three levels. The explicit, the allusive, and the mythopoetic.
Mythopoetic, obviously based on the world building.
Yes.
Again, this mythopoeia, yes.
So the most obvious references it makes are The Hobbit, which a lot of its readers would have known and a lot of people will know. The book begins with Bilbo and it centers around the One Ring and it starts in Hobbits. And this tells your readers, hey, you remember that Hobbit book? That was popular. This is part of that. The second way it works is kind of more in a more dispersed way. So it has these references to all these familiar fantasy things like wise elves and tunnels that are the dwarven town and mysterious evil. And then there is the more scholarly stuff like names and languages. And so like if you're a more educated reader or you know like classic folklore, you'll say, oh, cool, this is like that. Or nowadays we can see this concept is where this archetype comes from. And then the biggest way it works kind of intertextually is that it does this kind of world building thing. It balances giving you enough that you're like, oh, there's some depth here. But if you don't want that, you can just read it and have a fun adventure story.
Why should I read this book?
Every once in a while, I will see some aspect of nerd culture that I'm not familiar with, that I'm just like not into at all. But I will think, hey, I'm a nerd. Nerds like that thing over there. I'll probably like that thing over there. And I'll just try it out, right? This is how I got into graphic novels for the first time. This is how I started watching and then stopped watching Doctor Who, right? Like, it's just like...
you just follow the nerds. Where the nerds congregate, there goes Joe.
The herd nerd of sheep. Nerds.
Nerd herd. Yes. Nerd herd.
Nerd herd. Oh, litheads, you're so lucky you're already named. Otherwise, you'd for sure be the nerd herd.
Talk about noble.
2 points. 2 points, Ian.
So,
thank you.
So here, the Lord of the Rings movies are coming out. They're going to be the biggest thing on the planet. They're hyped forever. And I thought, man, I've read The Hobbit. I like fantasy. I've just never gotten into Lord of the Rings. I'm going to try it. And I read, I believe, a book a year. But I would just read the book before the film came out. And they were not what I was expecting, at least at first, right? There is, like, they are so often in places dense, right? They're full of, like, these elven songs that you can't pronounce or find a rhythm for. There's entire pages where people walk, eat, sleep, wake up and walk again, right? It's, like, that's like just narrative.
It's that like that. Get. It's like that section specifically, Joe. Just to jump in really, really fast. When they get to Rivendell, there's a part where Frodo is like wandering around. This is the like an elven home base, and he just hears some elves sing, like doing a poem or a song about a mythical figure from Tolkien's legendarium, Arendelle. And he just sits and listens to it. And Tolkien's like, "I'm putting the whole poem in," and we're like, "You don't know who this is." We don't care.
He's like, nope, shut up.
You are here for the page and a half. This is happening.
He does kind of hold you captive at some point.
Yeah, hostage is the right word.
Yeah.
But with that said, I think this book is awesome, right? Like, I really dig this book. And I think this book, it really pays off when you revisit it. All that stuff that you miss the first time or don't care about the first time, as you learn more about the world, as you learn more about the lore, it just pays off in spades.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I used to, I don't do this anymore because I have no time, but I used to read all three of these once a year around Christmas time. Just because I guess I had pretty narrow horizons. I don't know. What?
Mm-hmm. I said that's a lot of reading.
It is a lot
around a short period of time.
Ian, it's so funny. If I could interject with a very brief story. It's so funny that you say you would read them around Christmas time, because when my wife and I were first married, my wife comes from a family with a lot of Christmas tradition, like just baked into it.
Yeah.
And I don't come from that family. Like, I come from a family where some years Santa Claus won't come, right? Mm. Or where some years we wouldn't put up a Christmas tree because my mom couldn't be bothered, right? Like, that's the family I come
from. Or where there was like a knob of pus in Santa Claus's belly and you had to pull it out.
Perfect. You've got it. So the first year we were married, she's kind of running me through all these Christmas traditions, and we're decorating the house, and we're doing all this stuff that I don't have very much interest in. And we're watching a lot of bad Christmas movies, and I don't really like bad Christmas movies. So I told her, I lied to her, and I said, you know, we do have a Christmas tradition in my family.
Oh, Jesus.
And she said, really? What? Like, she's kind of excited. And I said, every year at Christmas, because this is when the movies came out, right? We watch the Lord of the Rings trilogy,
oh, right? Man.
Like, that's part of our trip. And we, for that very first year, I got away with it. We watched the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And guys, it was the best Christmas ever. Go ahead, Ian. I'm sorry.
Also, a tradition in my family is you buy Joe presents and you give him a massage.
That's right. There's a lot of family traditions, and I expect you to be on board with this.
Do you have any manipulative stories, Ian, that you'd like to share?
No, it's not manipulative. I'm just regretting that I didn't, like, because when I espoused my spouse, I could have done that. I could have said, hey, you know, we go to join a monster truck rally on Christmas Day. But
yeah, no. Joe, how did she find out?
This podcast.
Right. Is it right now? Did she just find out right now?
Yeah, so she is a faithful listener to this show. She may be finding out as we speak.
Oh, no.
Seriously?
I think she found out a long time ago. She has not allowed that for a very long time.
Yeah.
This is what the world needed, was more people like us talking about Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Oops. Oh, well.
Oops. We did it again.
If you've made it this far, we're sorry.
You know, we did show remarkable restraint in waiting until episode, 32? But the thing I think is
episode one, Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
To be fair, episode one was the hot.
I know.
Oh, shit.
Really, if you're looking for that kind of podcast, this is us. I think the reason I think canceled. The people who are not copies of us ought to read this book is because it's richer if a more diverse group is able to transform it. But people are fans. People love, like, creators
right.
love this stuff. And if a creator who is interesting, who is different from me, who has a different viewpoint and perspective, can read this and say, I liked a little bit of it. The rest I'm throwing out, but I'm going to draw upon this section. I think that's valuable. I think it's creativity fuel.
Who wants to read a final quote?
I do have 2 points that I acquired earlier in this episode that I was told I could cash in for something.
Ian actually also got 2 points, though.
I do, too.
Oh, no.
Joe, what do you have to read?
I was going to read the All That Is Gold Does Not Glitter quote.
Okay, I was going to read The Road Goes Ever On and On, so let's do both. Okay, this is the letter that Frodo has, that Gandalf has written to Frodo, and sent to the Prancing Pony. He writes his first letter, the body of the letter, telling him what to do, and then he does a PS, and then he does another PPS, and then after that he does one more PPPS. So this is in the middle. This is the PPS.
All right, Nick, I have a poem. All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadow shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king.
That's a good one. It's like one of those prophecies. Yeah. My quote is a poem that originally shows up in one form in The Hobbit, but we hear it twice in the story. The first time Bilbo says it, and he gives it kind of a positive spin. he talks about pursuing the road with eager feet. Because Bilbo loves adventure. Here, when Frodo says it, he's taking a journey not because he wants to, but because he believes he has to. And so he says this poem. The road goes ever on and on down from the door where it began. Now, far ahead, the road has gone, and I must follow, if I can, pursuing it with weary feet until it joins some larger way where many paths and errands meet. And whither then? I cannot say.
Litheads, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And happy birthday.
Happy birthday, JRR.